we stopped last time with the point on the subject of marriage, where, number two, the men were to learn how to correct their wife. And we talked about certain aspects of that particular point. Now, please understand, fellas, before we go on, that, and this applies to the women in a different way, but this part, of course, part one, which is now part two of the series on marriage, but we're addressing first the men's role, applies more directly to them, applies to both of you. How you demonstrate to God, husbands, that you can or cannot wisely lead and correct when necessary your wife tells God more about how you will rule cities than maybe anything else. We are all qualifying to rule cities. Somewhere in events of the last 20 years, and particularly since the death of Mr. Armstrong, people don't any longer seem to recognize, remember, and focus on daily that we are preparing, we are in training to rule cities, to reign with Christ. How we rule our lives, how we manage our lives, if you would, from the world's perspective, you might say it that way, but how we rule our lives, how we rule our appetites. If you're a husband, how you rule your family. Well, I'm a ruler. No, well, you better understand what God says a ruler is. You're a leader. You're a manager. You're in charge. So I guess in that sense, you rule. Ministers have a certain rule. I'm not a king. Neither is any elder a king. You're not a king. But understand that in a sense, you are a ruler. You are one who makes decisions and leads, and those decisions are binding. You're not a dictator or a monarch per se, an emperor or a king. But in fact, you are ruling. And therefore, how you rule reflects to God how much rule you should or should not be given. Now, if you either oppress your wife or you virtually abdicate, then obviously, as we talked about in point one, you have a problem either way. If your thought is, well, I just want to be gentle and kind, and I don't want to do anything, I don't want to ruffle any feathers, God says, well, no way I'm going to put you over cities, because you just, anything goes, it'd be just chaos. In your cities, we'd have basic anarchy. On the other hand, if you come across like a tyrant, when you correct your wife or when you lead and rule your family, then God says, well, there's no way I would put that person over cities, he'd just crush them. The moment they stepped out of line, he'd put them out like a cigarette. And so I can't do that. So it is a balance, and everything in life is a wise balance. So that's point number two. Now, number three. Point number three. Husbands, take the lead in the fine art of right communication. And I stress right communication. There are a lot of couples who have problems with communication. But they're not all the same kind of problem. There's two types of communication problems. There's miscommunication and there's no communication. Now, miscommunication could be wrong communication or bad communication or more miscommunication. But communication problems fall into two great categories. Either there's the wrong kind or there's none. Or not enough. I guess you could say there's a third category, but it's really part of not enough. What communication takes place may be good communication. It's just simply insufficient. Well, I never know what you're thinking. And that could be the wife saying it to the husband if he doesn't take the lead. Well, honey, I'm Gary Cooper. He's my hero. I'm the strong, silent type. When you see me, you should see Alan Ladd. Today, you don't see many of the strong, silent types. You don't see many strong or silent. They have a lot to say, and they're not very strong. the models that are out there today, and it's the opposite of the strong silent types. Now, it's better to have a strong silent type than a weak silent type as a husband, but if you're silent all the time, you're going to hear your wife say, you know, I just wonder what's on your mind. You never tell me what you're thinking. And it can be the other way around. Take the lead. If you're married to a woman who doesn't say much, who's just content to not say much, you have to take the lead. Draw her out. A strong silent type might work for the movies, but it doesn't work in marriage. It just does not work. So that's a problem with no communication or not enough communication. But sometimes people will come and they'll counsel and they say, we have a communication problem. The assumption is that there's not enough communication going on. And as I've heard in a number of marriage counsels, oh, there's plenty of communication in our marriage. It's just all bad. And if you just tell my wife, or if you just tell my husband, when there's the wrong kind of communication, eventually you will end up with no communication. Because somebody will turn off, or both will turn off. Now, that no communication could mean divorce. In the world, that's what it means. And those couples are not communicating anymore. So if there's too much of the wrong kind of communication, oh, there's plenty of communication, but it's wrong, eventually that's going to lead to no communication too, because it's going to mean no marriage. Now, in God's church, it won't mean that. Marriage is for life. We're bound for life. People who know the truth are bound for life. I will cover that under the subject of divorce and remarriage. The exceptions to that are clear in the scripture. So, you know, people may get a divorce, I suppose, in God's church, and we'll talk about that too, but they're bound under certain circumstances, but they may not be communicating. So communication should not, on the part of the husband who's taking the lead, be harsh. It should not be superior. It should not be moody. It should be tender. Is it understanding? Is it kind? Sometimes taking the lead in right communication, fellas, does not mean doing the talking. It means doing a lot of listening. I've heard people say, what a wonderful conversationalist so-and-so is. And you go talk to so-and-so. What did you say? I didn't say a thing. I just listened. They thought I was a wonderful conversationalist. Sometimes a woman who's been battling the children at home, you know, and struggling with the plumbing and the toilet backed up and smelling stinky diapers and whatever else is going on at home, she just wants to talk to an adult human being. She's seen all these little people all day. She's blown noses, wiped noses, boiled things over on the stove because the dog was chewing on the cat and whatever else was going on. The cat was clawing the dog's eyes out, and you see the pictures. And so she just needs to talk to an adult. She doesn't want to talk to puppies anymore, doesn't want to talk to little people anymore, and needs to talk. So all the husband has to do is come home and say, tell me about your day. I appreciated my mother. I have this vision of my mother, and I probably told this in sermons. When my father got home, there was a time in his life when he traveled. He would sometimes be gone for a whole week. He'd leave Monday and be home on Friday. That was not often. He could often be gone a night or two. But if he was gone even one night, let alone four, he was rarely home every night of a week. But when he walked in the door, I don't care what my mother was doing, she stopped and sat down, curled up on the couch. My mother was triple jointed, and I have this vision of her. She could curl up on the couch. She you know, I don't even know if she was born with bones. She just could do things, and she'd pretzel herself up on the couch and talk to my father. And he would tell her about various clients and sales prospects and things that he'd done, and she would listen. They'd have a drink or something, and it was wonderful. My mother was definitely a talker, but she knew when to listen. My dad would take the lead, and then he would always ask what happened, and she would give a report on the kids. And sometimes I would stand around the corner as a child and listen to the report, and I can remember the days, you're going to have to do something with David. And I always knew, oh no, I'm going to die. But recognize that you went to work, husbands, and you talked to adults. Your wife stayed home and talked to people who may someday be adults, but it's different. So take the lead. Your wife has hopes and dreams and purposes and goals and is going to be a member of the God family someday. Now with that, please turn to Proverbs chapter 15. Proverbs 15. Proverbs 15 and verse 23. A man has joy by the answer of his mouth, and a word spoken in due season, how good it is. You come home and you can bring something to your wife. Now, obviously, the wife has to be willing to listen. We'll talk a little bit more about that next time. But you can bring that word in due season. Verse 26, the thoughts of the wicked are an abomination to the Lord, but the words of the pure are pleasant words. Do you bring words of pleasantness? That's technically what the Hebrew means, words of pleasantness. If you come home and constantly just dump on your wife what happened to you at the office, you know, and she's had a day of it, then both of you are going to need to have a listener when one of you has got to be the listener while the other one talks. Both of you may want to talk. So you have to learn the balance on those things. It's very, very important. Verse 18, a wrathful man stirs up strife, but he that is slow to anger appeases strife. You know, if your wife maybe is combative, the husband's responsibility, and believe me, husbands can be too, but if she's combative, the husband has to take the lead in right communication. A soft answer might turn away strife. Of course, it's wrath in the verse. But it's important to understand that. A lack of right communication is the single greatest cause of marital breakup. Second is financial problems. Third is sex. Fourth is a couple that's childless or whatever. I think they're stacked up. Or in child rearing problems. I think the fourth is child rearing problems. Fifth is people actually will split up because they can't bear children. One in every 12 Americans, one in every 12 married people, one out of every 12 married people cannot have a child. Well, what that means is one in every 6 couples is barren. Does it make a difference whether one or both of the mates is infertile? You're not going to have children. So when you have one in 12, that means one in every 6 couples cannot bear children. That becomes a reason people break up. Death of a child. There are various things that cause marital breakup. But at the top is communication of the wrong kind or lack of communication. There are people who end a marriage out of sheer loneliness. They choose to become single so that they are free, or they sometimes go off into adultery and they look for illicit relationships because they're lonely in the marriage. Another point, the tone, the way you speak, a husband's tone is very important to the wife. It's very, very important to the wife. Not as important to the husband, it's important. If the wife talks like a shrew to her husband and nags and does other things, of course, there are problems there. But just tone. I mean, it's two different things. You say, honey, is the dinner ready? Honey, is the dinner ready? Exact same words. You know, I remember this funny counseling session. This woman came in and the man was there. This actually happened. I remember the minister telling me the story. But I saw this once myself, similar, but the story that was related to me was even funnier. Yet it was not. I guess it's funny. It's sad in a way. But the man came home and walked in the door, and dinner was not ready. And of course, they were relating this later to a minister because they had communications problems. He said, "The dinner isn't ready yet." And they were asking the minister what he thought, and the man was relating it this way. He said, "All I said to her is the dinner not ready yet?" And same words. Tone was obviously very different. I've often seen that. How the man may think he's saying it is not necessarily how it's being heard, or in fact, he's saying it. He's not saying it. Now, make no mistake, there's no communication going on in a fight, except it's all bad. Any points of reason are lost. Epithets hurled, name-calling is remembered. If you remember that about arguments, you'll be wise and avoid them. Every couple has fights, has arguments. But remember, logic and rationale, good solid reasons are lost when there's emotion, but name-calling and epithets against the other person, denigration of the other person, is always remembered. Number four. To the men, remember this, these points are to the men, have a proper understanding of sex and marriage. Now, I mentioned at the outset last week that we're going to have this book, a rewriting. It'll be a shorter form of Mr. Armstrong's Ambassador College, really textbook-length book entitled The Missing Dimension in Sex. Our title is Sex, The Unknown Dimension. It'll be more like a big booklet than that long book necessary, he felt, for the training of leaders in the work and as a college textbook. And I hope the brethren all understand it's not going to be a long book, but it will cover certain things. And we are going to have a dating and courtship booklet, which did not exist, nor was there really a divorce and remarriage booklet. We're having to write certain booklets that did not exist. I've written, 10 or 12 books or booklets that Mr. Armstrong never had to write. But obviously, we're not going to do Mystery of the Ages. So there are certain things that we're doing a little differently because the circumstances are different. I know you all understand that. That book will go into more detail, and it's coming soon enough that I probably don't need to take much time here. But it's a matter of manly pride. Turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. A lot of men, because of what Hollywood has done to marriage, because of the false image that Hollywood has of sex in marriage, men don't want to admit that they're not wonderful Hollywood-like lovers, and they often will not get help, and women are frustrated. So there's got to be a proper understanding of sex in marriage. I'd like to read a few verses here. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1. Now, this is basic understanding from God. Frankly, there's even a command in here. Now, concerning the things whereof you wrote me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, he didn't say, I'm saying that. He said, you wrote unto me concerning what you wrote me. This is not Paul saying it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Well, if you're not married to her, it's certainly good not to go touch the woman. But the fact is, if you're married to her, you ought to touch her from time to time, fellas. And I think we all understand that. But he's saying, you wrote this unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife. Now, some people were saying, are you saying, Paul, that maybe it would be good if we didn't get married because of this present distress and persecution? And Paul had suggested that. But nevertheless, to avoid fornication, if you can't withhold yourself, you're going to go fornicate, get married. Have your own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Now, let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence. Now, that's so King James-ish, due benevolence. Well, what does that mean? Well, be benevolent to him when it's due. What does that mean? Here's what it means, and the Greek is very plain. It's talking about sexual responsibility. Render unto the wife his sexual responsibility. And likewise also the wife unto the husband. There is a sexual responsibility that twain shall be one flesh. The very first commandment God ever gave regarding marriage is that they twain, these two, shall be one flesh. Now this is a command from God. Some couples, and it can be the husband too. Typically the jokes are about the woman who says, I have a headache, but I'm tired, whatever, the kids can hear us, and all the other list of things, and the jokes are about the women. Sometimes it's the man. The man comes home, he's tired, he doesn't exercise enough, doesn't get enough sleep, and begins to lose his virility, and pretty soon he's disinterested. The wife has not power of her own body, but the husband. You know what that's saying? The wife's body belongs to her husband. And likewise also the husband has not power of his own body, but the wife. Now, obviously, men and women have power over their own bodies. But when it's talking about sex, God says something is different here. It changes. The wife's body belongs to the husband, and the husband's the wife's. It is literally thievery to withhold sex in a marriage. Do benevolence, as the King James translators put it. Quite literally, you wives, when you take care of your body or don't, you are taking care or not taking care of your husband's body. Husbands, when you take care of your body or don't, you are taking care of or not taking care of your wife's body. If you don't take care of your body, God says you're not hurting yourself. Of course, if you know the husband doesn't exercise, gets overweight, clogs up his arteries, he's going to die, and the impact is on him. But what you are doing is you are dishonoring a body that God says belongs to your wife. The power over your body, you may think you have it, but it's actually your wife has power over your body when it comes to sex. Now, if you ruin your body so that sex is terribly unattractive, either the wife or the husband, looking either way, and you just don't take care of yourself, there is a responsibility there, because you are doing that to your mate's body, you see, not your own. Defraud you not one the other. There's no doubt what this is talking about. Except it be with consent for a time. Maybe there's this period of time. Now there's a lesson in here, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again. Remember, the whole subject here was touching each other. And then come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency, or that means your inconsistency. There's not enough sex in the marriage, or lovemaking, as we would better call it. Now let's stop and consider for a moment. If basically there is to be sexual contact and intimacy, lovemaking in the marriage between husband and wife, except where by agreement there is special fasting and prayer involved, the indication is very clear that long stretches of no sexual contact between mates is verboten, is wrong in marriage, and is defrauding one another and disobeying God. Why? Well, how long does a typical fast go? Now, you might have a period where you're doing a number of short fasts together, and it's prayer and fasting together, because if it was just prayer, you're doing that every day. In Bible study, that's pretty much supposed to be every day. If you fasted every day, you'd die. So we all understand that fasting is a periodic thing. So where there is a need to do extra fasting, if it's a one-day fast, husbands and wives, you should not have sexual relations. That's what God says. You know, you may not be fasting together. My wife and I will sometimes fast together, and sometimes we fast separately. Mates do that. We obviously always fast together on the Day of Atonement, but other than that, it doesn't have a pattern. But sometimes by agreement, by consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to prayer and fasting. It might be one wants to do that, because that one mate is having more problems spiritually. The other one may want to fast and pray at the same time, because you are one. You know, it's a physical union, but a divine institution ordained of God. You know the way the marriage ceremony reads, and you are one flesh in the sense of sex. I mean, you are one. Two are better than one. There are a lot of reasons, but one reason is if one is struggling with a spiritual problem, the other one can sign on to pray and fast and support the other one. That's another reason two are better than one. So it might mean that there's prayer and fasting by both parties in the marriage, and as a result, there would not be, during that period of time, if it's a series of fasts, you wouldn't have sex over that period. There would not be lovemaking. But the whole point is, unless it's a short period like that, you come together. So the once-a-month approach, whether you need it or not, so to speak, doesn't work in marriage. It doesn't work in marriage. Once every 2 weeks, wrong. Now, as you get older, you slow down, and that's understood, and those things will be covered more in the booklet. I just don't have time to cover all of it now. Paul went on to talk about, but I speak this by permission and not of commandment. Now, he's not talking about what he just said. He's talking about what he's about to say. So don't misunderstand what you just read there. Now, I'm giving this by permission and not of commandment. For I would that all men were even as myself, but every man has his proper gift of God, one after this manner, another after that. It's a very difficult time of persecution. Paul was once married. How do you know that? Well, he had to be married to be a member of the Sanhedrin, and he was. Apparently, his wife left him. You don't hear any more about Peter's wife. You know that he was married because his mother-in-law got sick, but you don't hear any more about her. Could she have left him? Probably. It certainly disqualified him to be a pope, I can tell you that, although the early popes were all married. But the fact is, Paul's wife must have left him, or she died. I suppose it's possible that she died, either way. But he wound up single, and he understood that there was a certain freedom in that. And if you have a wife and children, during difficult times that lie ahead, there's problems. That's why God talks about during the time of flight. It's more difficult if you have a little baby and you're giving suck to a little child and you're fleeing. There's just a greater duress. And this is not primarily what the sermon is about, but I just wanted to be sure that nobody thought that verse 6 is attached to verses 1 to 5. It's attached to verse 7. Now, when we get into divorce and remarriage, we'll come right back here to chapter 7, and we'll talk about it in some significant detail. But this applies here. So, you know, there's no such thing as an immaculate conception. You know, the whole idea of the immaculate conception is ridiculous, you know, of Mary. Mary was a virgin, but to call it an immaculate conception, immaculate implies clean. In other words, all sex is dirty, and that was an immaculate conception. It was called immaculate because it was clean. There was a conception there. So if sex is dirty, then God did a dirty act with Mary. That's why I want to make that clear. This whole idea that sex is sort of dirty, and this Victorian prudery has carried in generations from some families. And it's wrong. It's just so wrong. And it can be both ways. I've seen frigid men that the council men who were frigid. That's primarily more a problem with women, but not entirely. And now it's not nearly the problem that it once was. There's very little of that kind of thinking around anymore in the most amoral age the world has ever seen. Hebrews 13 and verse 4. Hebrews 13 and verse 4. Marriage is honorable in all. And it's not and, it's more, let the bed be undefiled. Marriage is honorable. You know, what's done in the marriage bed is honorable. It's good. It's not wrong. It's not bad. But whoremongers and adulterers, God will judge. Now, that's outside the marriage bed. That's a different bed. That's somebody else's bed. That's the non-marriage bed. But marriage is honorable in all. What's it talking about? Well, of course, marriage generally, but most specifically, sex, the marriage bed. You don't eat your meals in bed. You don't cut the grass in bed. It's what goes on in bed. Although I guess you could eat breakfast in bed occasionally. Our children used to bring us breakfast in bed when it was Mother's Day and Father's Day and so forth. And that's wonderful. Chapter 5 of Proverbs, let's go back there. Chapter 5, Proverbs 5, and verse 15. Now, this is basic. This is the kind of basic stuff. This is just straight up. It's in the Bible. And here it is. The sex book is going to be very graphic. You go back and read Mr. Armstrong's book, and it was graphic. I mean, if we were that graphic, we couldn't even put it up on the internet. So we have to be a little more careful today. I hope you understand that. There's drawings and illustrations that are beyond what we would be able to put up there, and I want to be able to post it. I think we do. We're going to visit that after I write it and see what we think. We might have an online version, and we might have another version. We'll just see. God will show us what to do. But Proverbs 5 and verse 15, drink waters out of your own cistern. Well, that's not talking about water. And running waters out of your own well. It's talking about sex in marriage. Don't sample other people's husbands or wives. This is written from the perspective of my son, verse 1, but it's talking about both. Avoid strange women, verse 3, but I mean, it means both. And there's an awful lot of adultery out there on both parts. One half of all women who are married commit adultery. One half. So it's not all just men, but it's about 66% of men. 2 out of 3. You see 6 married couples, 4 of the men are cheating and 3 of the wives are. That's the fact. And since it's not always the same, that means that 5 out of 6 of those marriages, on average, somebody's cheating. One man once said, I was listening to him, he's a rock star. He said, I'm married, but I consider my wife like fruit. And I enjoy my wife, but you wouldn't just eat apples all the time. He went on, he said, sometimes you might want to try oranges or bananas. And that was all he saw it as. He says, just because I like apples doesn't mean I don't like other kinds of fruit. Sometimes I want grapes. He just kept going on. And his wife was aware of it. He was explaining how she understood his need for different kinds of fruit. He was into fruit salad, I guess. Verse 16, let your fountains be dispersed abroad, and the rivers of waters in the street. Let them be only your own, and not strangers with you. Yet let your fountain be blessed, and rejoice with the wife of your youth. Let her be as the loving hind and pleasant roe. Let her breast, not anybody else's, satisfy you at all times, and be you ravished always with her love. The Hebrew there for ravished is intoxicated. It literally means, in the Hebrew, intoxicated, to reel like a drunkard. Could that be your marriage? Where you're literally intoxicated with one another? Yeah, when we were 22. But it all changed when we hit 23. Intoxicated, real like a drunkard. That's a wonderful picture from God. I mean, God was no Victorian prude, I'll tell you. God designed everything that had to do with marriage. And why will you, my son, be ravished with a strange woman and embrace the bosom of a stranger? For the ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his goings. That is all in the context of how you handle sex in marriage. God watches everything. So, have a proper understanding of sex in marriage. God wants sexual fulfillment in marriage. He designed it and he wants it. You know, there's this whole idea that it's only something men enjoy. That's ridiculous. And of course, this is something that has to be explained too. That booklet will address it. Point number 5, to husbands, little things mean a lot. Yesterday was Valentine's Day, and people are talking about, you give your wife this or that or the other little special thing, show her you love her on Valentine's Day. That's about as silly as saying that there's something wrong with your church, because we don't keep Valentine's Day, of course. If you don't keep Christmas, you don't believe in giving. And we always explain, yes, we do. And you ought to tell your relatives, we just believe in giving for the other days of the year. I guess maybe we'd subtract Valentine's too. Maybe we'd subtract Easter. We wouldn't give any Easter presents. Maybe we'd subtract Halloween. Maybe we're down to 361 or something. And birthdays, if it's not any one of those, you're down to 360. So I remember when I was telling my parents that, they were these nominal Christians when I was first called, later God called them, and I said, I'm not going to keep Christmas. You don't believe in giving? What kind of Christianity is that? I said, and I was armed, and I handled most things wrong with my parents, but I did handle that right, and I said, that means, Mom, I remember my mom saying, I'm going to be able to give to you all through the year. Would you rather I did it on Christmas because I had to? Or would you like to be surprised and know all through the year that I could give you something when I don't have to? She said, hey, that makes sense to me. She liked that. And so I went away, wiping my forehead, because I handled it wrong most of the time. I remember how I told them I wasn't going to vote, wasn't going to fight, wasn't going to eat pork, and had to keep the Sabbath, and would not be cutting the grass anymore on Saturday. I remember explaining all those things to my father as announcements. like the Pope speaking ex cathedra from the chair. And I finally wised up a little bit. My parents told me I did, and they actually said later, you know, when we saw how much you changed, that's when we looked into the religion. I didn't know how to take that. Ooh, that's good now, but ooh, they're saying I had a lot to change. I don't know how I feel about that. Little things mean a lot. Think in terms of little gifts for your wife. A little pat here on the shoulder, just a little touch. The only time you ever touch her, it's because you want to go to bed. Then that's not good. That sends a signal that you're interested in yourself. Now stop and think, too. When your wife cooks, she may have been spending all day cooking. You didn't. I didn't. She's cooking, and you taste your food. She's waiting. The big moment. What does he think? Now, she hears nothing. Absolutely nothing. And there's going to be disappointment. Or maybe a grunt. Good. Or something like Chief Crazy Horse or something. He says, how? He's probably not saying, how did you make this? If you like it, say something. If you can't think of anything else to say, say, this is interesting pudding. This is really interesting pudding. This pudding is really something. Now, you can say that about her dress, her hair, or anything. I mean, that's a safe statement. She goes away at least confused, and if she's willing to, if you say it with a smile, and you hug her when you say it, that your hairstyle, honey, that is something. Hug her. But if you always say interesting, or that pudding is something, then you're probably eventually she's going to figure out your code. So find a way to say something nice. She's trying new perfume. She's decorated the house differently. She's moved the furniture. You know, I would come home, and my mother would have just moved the furniture. Sometimes my wife would just move the furniture. It's all different. I never liked it at first. Never. But within 2 days, I didn't even remember she'd done it. And I was perfectly happy with it, and then upset. I got to where I would find it. Wait a minute. I figured out my reaction. You know what? I didn't like this at first. Now I'm actually saying I don't want you moving my chair, keep it here when I didn't like it. I finally figured out I'll like it within 2 days, and I always did. And she was practical, and so she knew where to move the furniture, and I basically just had to remember to check before I sat in a certain place, and or I could hit the floor or whatever. That wasn't quite that bad. But anyway, thank her. Say something. That's great. Wow. New marriages, it's particularly important because you don't have much money. You may not be able to afford a lot of exotic dishes or perfume or extra furniture or even a hairstyle for X number of dollars that you could afford later on. So find ways to compliment each other. Honey, you really folded the wash well. It just looks so good. I hate to unfold it and put on these underwear. Find something to say. Be creative. All right. If she's got a dress on that's purple, chartreuse, burnt orange, red with polka dots of various colors besides, you may need to say, honey, it's stitched well. It's really got good stitching. But you know what? It's not really you. It's just not you. Purple, chartreuse, burnt orange, red polka dots. And it may be absolutely terrible. First, talk about the stitching or something. We're having fun here, brethren, and I'm deliberately trying to have a little fun because it shows you can think of something to say. You say, you know, this isn't burned as bad as the last time. This is better. You're on your way. There's progress, honey. 4 more times and it'll be just right. Okay. Little things mean a lot. How sad that in the world they think Valentine's Day is when you sort of think about your mate. You know, the day for lovers. And every day should be that way, going back to the previous point. Number 6, be faithful to your wife. Now, I'm not just talking about adultery, and this is not coming off of point 4, have a proper understanding of sex. Of course it's related if you commit adultery, but I'm going beyond that. This is a provocative world. How long ago was the song, you know, Girl Watching came out? Oh, I don't do anything. I just watch them. Music to watch girls by. Remember the song? And you see men craning their necks. There have been, I saw a show one time, did a kind of a test. They had these beautiful women walk down the street in New York, and somebody sat with a camera, and they wanted to film the couples that passed them and catch the guys craning their necks. Now, every man has probably done that, I suppose, and I suppose women could take a second look if Tom Selleck or somebody walked by, but I'm sure they would, but it's wrong. It's wrong. Now, it's not just wrong if your wife sees you. It's not just don't let your wife see you. Okay, where's my wife? I don't want to sin with her watching. I want to, you see, because Christ said he who looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery already with her in his heart. Yes, you can notice people of the opposite sex. You know, you don't walk along like a horse with blinders. You know, I grew up and the man would bring the milk to our house and the horse pulled the wagon. And I was back in the early 50s and I can remember the horse would come down the street pulling the wagon, had these things on. I wondered, why was that? I went out, I was just this curious little kid, and I went out and I said, why are these things on there? And I said, he said, well, I want the horse to see straight ahead and not get distracted. And this horse, sure enough, would just clop, 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 clop down the road and growing up. And there's always the milk wagon pulled by a horse. You know, those were the days. That's not that long ago. Then eventually it was a truck. And now, of course, you go get your milk. They don't bring it to your house. But I can remember when the milkman would come to the door. The iceman, mailman, and all the different people that came to the door. Mailman, I guess, comes out, still comes, but doesn't come up to the house. You can watch girls at the office and be unfaithful. Peep shows and magazines and some of the sick, terrible, terrible, awful stuff on television that comes into the house. I told my wife, I just said, look, I sometimes will surf through channels and I'll see stuff so hideous I can't even believe it. So I told my wife, see these stations? Block them. If I'm just surfing down looking for, I don't even want to come to those stations, so put that block on them and just do it. And she figured out how to do it. And I'm not very computer-oriented or whatever you'd have to do. But anyway, she's got the block on there, which parents have. I didn't want it coming in my house. I just do not want it. I don't want to see it. Of course, parents think, well, it's okay if we see it in the world. We just don't want our kids to see it. And so you have the parents' block on computers, too. You know, the kids can find this awful stuff. And people grow up with a spirit of unfaithfulness. It doesn't always have to be that they would go commit adultery. Remember, God says you cleave to your mate. You leave your father and your mother. Now, there's another meaning to be faithful to your wife. If you're still married to your parents, you're still a mama's boy, or you never cut loose from your father, and you can be unfaithful in two separate ways. If you do not leave your father and mother and cleave to your mate, there's two separate ways you can do it. Number one, you stay physically close. You stay in the house. You never go out and get your own house, your own life. That's wrong. That absolutely defies what God said, and we talked about it a little bit last time. Leave your father and mother. It's not a suggestion. It's just get out. Now, there could be a temporary time, and we're talking about married couples here. It could be a short space. And this is very rare, frankly, where there's a short space of time where it might have to happen or somebody comes back temporarily because there's an emergency. And as Christians, we have to care for one another, particularly in the, you know, I'm talking about in the family. They may have to take somebody in because of circumstances. They have no other place to go. That's different. But that's one problem. It's being unfaithful to your wife. You can't cut the cord. Well, I'm mama's boy, and I'm going to die mama's boy, and you just fit in around mama, you know, the wife is told, so to speak. There's another way, though, and that is you never quite cut the cord of comparison. Well, my father, there could be the wife saying this, and I'll show what the husband says. My father was like this. This is the kind of father he was, and you're a different kind of father. Well, obviously you're a different kind of father because you're a different person. Or it could be if you got a mama's boy, I learned real quickly not to compare my mother's cooking to my wife's cooking. Not good, fellas, not good. My mother was an unbelievable, way beyond the moon, gourmet cook. She could do anything with her eyes closed. And my wife is an incredible cook, too. And in a way, my wife had to teach herself. My mother was taught by her mother. So in a way, I've come to almost appreciate what my wife did. But I had to, my entire childhood, I had to do the dishes with my brother and sister. Either we'd go every 3 days, and my dad would come in and do inspection. Now, I'll tell you why I'm saying that in a moment. Sometimes we'd go a whole week, and it'd be my older sister and younger brother, and we would shift. And my dad inspected every night. I told you, it was a military family. He would come in, and he had to pass inspection. Well, my mother's kitchen, after she had cooked, looked like a bus that had been bombed. The kitchen looked like multiple explosions had gone off. I mean, her motto was, I can mess it up, and I feed you this wonderful food. My dad's thought was, you sure do. And it was real easy for him, who didn't have to either cook it or wash, to say, the kids clean it up. I just remember at times, I was so tired. I come from swimming practice. I mean, all through high school, right up till I went to college. And that's another reason. There's no way I was going to live at home while I was going to college. I was so thankful God called me for that reason. I cannot do the dishes from 2,000 miles away. But I remember going in there and thinking, look at this. There were times where there'd be so many different, just unbelievable. I remember one time, I said, is there any place, a single place on any counter that's not a mess? And my mother was a very good housekeeper. Later on, she would, she got older, it was a little tougher for her, but she was a good housekeeper. But man, in the kitchen, I used to kid her. I said, Mom, as you walk out, is this the last thing you do? Do you just throw a hand grenade? I mean, do you just throw a hand grenade? You know, I kid with her, and she'd laugh, and she understood, and it was fun with my mother. So I can't go comparing that kind of a cook to my wife. But before my wife had... before she had learned to be the wonderful cook that she is, and before I had learned not to compare her, two things intersected on the graph that were both bad, very bad. And I reminded her, I think, about half of once about my mother's cooking, and my wife instantly healed me right on the spot. And I didn't do it too often after that, I don't think. Genesis chapter 11. And verse 27. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, that's Abraham later, Nahor and Haran, and Haran begat Lot. Okay, Lot was, of course, Abraham's nephew, so now you understand that. Well, I'm sure you know the verse. Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. This is up in what would be modern-day Iraq or Mesopotamia. The name of Abram's wife was Sarah, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, and the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. You can get the connections there. But Sarah was barren. She had no child. And Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son's, Abraham's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur the Chaldees into the land of Canaan, and they came into Haran and dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get you out of your country, and from your kindred, and from your father's house, unto a land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. Of course, we're covering all of this in American, Britain, and Bible Prophecy. Mr. Armstrong, of course, covered it in great detail. And I will bless you and make your name great. And I will bless them that bless you and curse them that curse you. And in you shall all families of the earth be blessed. Of course, there's two great promises there. I will make of you a great nation. That's the promise of what we often call the promise of race, which means the promise of physical, material, national wealth. And then the latter part of verse 3 is a reference to in you, through Christ, Galatians 3 talks about this. Shall all families of the earth be blessed? Salvation is through Christ, who was a descendant of Abraham later. So Abram departed, as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old, and he departed out of Haran. All right, now, here is this man who moves twice. Sarah comes along with him. And just keeps coming. Just whatever he did, she did. She was faithful to him. She stayed with him. Why? Because he was a faithful husband. Yes, he made some mistakes. You know the story of Abimelech. But you know what? They were barren. She stayed with him. Who knew if she was barren or he was barren? Maybe they knew. It's being recorded now that Sarah was barren. But who knew whether it was her fault or his fault? She might have said, hey, this is my chance to get out of here. So she left him. And it might have been his chance to say, you know what, this is her fault. I don't want her coming with me. But they stayed together. They were faithful to one another. They didn't look for a way out. Whither Abraham went, quoting Ruth, she wentest, so to speak. She stayed with him. Point number 7. Encourage your wife to become herself. Encourage her to become herself. Now, this is so crucial to understand. Your wife is whoever she is. She is not someone from Hollywood. She's not your girlfriend from high school. She's not your sister. She's not your mother. She's not the woman next door or across the street. She's not your secretary. She's not anybody other than who she is. Your job is to help your wife maximize who she is. My wife loves music. I like music. She plays instruments. I was an athlete. You know, we kind of battled back and forth, had a lot of fun with our children growing up. And I wanted them to be athletes, and she wanted them to be musicians. And we sort of said, well, all right, they're going to learn music. I liked that idea. I thought that was great. And so she taught them all. They all had to play accordion first. Her father played the accordion. She and her sisters played the accordion, and she loved it. And they had little accordions, then a little bit bigger accordions, and so forth, and got bigger. And then they could pick something else. Well, you know, our one son picked a trombone, the other one picked a trumpet, and then our daughter picked the flute. But all along, Dad was teaching them sports, see. And eventually they found their true calling, which was sports. But I'm just kidding. But my wife was different. Now, about the time I'd try to make her an athlete, or she'd try to make me a musician, yes, I like to dance and sing, and she likes to take walks and do certain things that are athletic. But the fact is, about the time that would have happened, that would have been similar to detonating a weapon of mass destruction in our home. So she has her own interests and abilities. There should be some things that overlap, of course. There has to be some common ground. There has to be. Let's look over to Ephesians chapter 5. But still, your wife has to be who she is. We're all to grow in Christ's character, but you know, there are a lot of things we're not told about Christ. They're just personal things about him. Sometime I'll give a whole sermon on this. I said I would a few years ago and never did it. It's going to be a sermon on all the things we are not told about Christ. We'll go through them. I'll give you one example, and then I'll tell you why we're not told these things. The Bible does not record, for instance, Christ's favorite color. Do you imagine that he liked certain things? I'll bet he did. He probably had a favorite ice cream if they had ice cream back then. I don't know. We don't know his favorite dessert. We could pick that. Why? Because if we knew, we might all wear that color and that dessert, and those things have nothing to do with developing the character of God. So Christ's personal preferences, I'm sure he had an architectural style he liked, certain clothing styles. If we knew exactly how he cut his hair, we'd probably all cut our hair exactly the same way. The Bible doesn't tell us that. We know he didn't have long hair, but we don't know a lot of other things. We don't know what his personal interests were and certain things that he did for recreation. What sports did he like? Why? Because that was independent to him and has nothing to do with how we seek salvation. Your wife and you have certain things that are simply you. If they're sin and wrong and have to do with character, they've got to be unlearned. But if they're different, if it's just you, you like sports and she likes music or vice versa, That's the way it is. That's the way it is. Now, Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 26, we'll pick it up again. We read last time. The man is to sanctify and cleanse it, a type of husbands loving your wives, with the washing of water and the word. This is what Christ did, but it's a type that he might present it to himself, a glorious church. You're going to, in a certain sense, present your wife as this glorious woman, a type of the church to Christ. Now, how are you going to do that if you try to get her to be something she's not? You don't bring her to her own potential. Christ is not bringing the true church of God to look like a group of good Buddhists or good Shintoists, you see, or Taoists. He wants us to be what we can be as a wife, the particular wife he wants to marry, not like somebody else's wife. There are other women pictured as churches in the Bible. Revelation 17 is a very different picture of Revelation 12. There are men that want their wives to look garish. I remember one couple that left us shortly after the I announced we were not going to be wearing makeup in the Restored Church of God. And the problem was not the woman. She was not happy with it. But her husband said, "I like my wife with makeup." Didn't make any difference what Mr. Armstrong taught or what history shows about the purpose of makeup. He wanted his wife to wear makeup, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies, and so forth. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Look at a couple of verses there. Notice this. Now, this has been hard for some women to swallow, and they don't understand these verses. And this is important. It's part of the overall picture here. Now, in verse 6, "For if a woman be not covered," that's having long hair, "let her be shorn." That's proof it's talking about hair. "But if it be a shame for a woman to be shorn or shaven, let her be covered." If it's wrong to have short hair, then go all the way and just have it covered. It's not talking about hats. "For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, for as much as he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of the man." Now, that's God's own instructions here, ladies and fellas. Now, it's kind of like who gets to be in charge. Remember what we talked about last week. Let me explain. The woman could sit and say, "You get to be the glory of Christ, but I'm only the glory of you." I mean, think about that for a moment. Think about what it just said there. The man is supposed to reflect the glory of Christ, but the woman of the man. That's what it says. To you women who think that's unfair, I would remind you the pressure is far greater on the man. He had better reflect Christ's glory. You only have to reflect his. Think about that. And you men who think, "You're the glory of me," and you pronounce it sort of like Alexander the Great might have said it, then recognize the other side of that. Is your life reflecting the glory of Christ? She's only got to reflect the glory of you. It's kind of who's in charge. Do you want to report to your husband, or do you want to report to Christ directly? I look back and I realize the pressure that was on Mr. Armstrong. He reported to Christ that, well, he gets to be in charge. Not that I ever coveted it, please don't misunderstand me, but I often looked at my boss at times and thought, boy, it must be fun to be in charge. And, you know, while I was interning as a minister, eventually I was in charge of a pastorate. And then after for a while, I wasn't because of events as Mr. Armstrong died, and I've told you about that. And then I remembered what it was like, and I wanted that, but I never, ever, ever wanted to be in charge of the church. Never did, humanly speaking. And I'm convinced that one of the reasons I'm in the position I am today is it never crossed my mind, I tell you, before God, it never did. But I can understand now, it's a lot easier, ladies, and I tell our staff this, you should not want my position. You should not want your husband's position in the home, because you are saying that you would rather be in a position of answering directly to Christ as the head of the home. It's important you understand you are the glory of your husband, but you husbands cannot try to make your wife over into your own image. You married her. You didn't marry anybody else. If your first wife dies, you've got even a more difficult problem. You can't try to make your second wife your first wife. You can't do that. Let her be herself. Encourage her and give her a little budget to go develop her interests and abilities. There has to be some money involved. Here, honey, no problem. Here's a dollar. You don't even have to give me the rest. Keep the change. That won't do it. I don't know that would have done it 100 years ago. A dollar might have gotten something. I don't know. But give her enough of a budget, because when you give her a budget that is just so tight, and I realize that our budgets may all be tight. It's the end of the age. It's expensive to live. And what could be done even 10 years ago, let alone 30 years ago, is very different. Very different. We had to manage money. We never had any money. We never had any money. My parents were successful, but my dad always said, look, I'll just tell you right now, son, what you get from me will be when I die. And you'll thank me for it. And I thought, oh, but I'd just like to be, maybe a little now. If you'd help me, I was struggling. I was systematically underpaid for reasons in the past that I've sort of explained. And our children had to wear their older cousins' hand-me-downs. You know, little boys in Milwaukee and Atlanta sent their clothes so that little boys wherever in New York had shirts to wear. And my wife had to be very, very inventive, and it was difficult. And yet she found a way. Now, you wives, be creative. Don't lay it all on your husband's shoulders. The minister said that if you granted me $1,000 a week, two would be better, that I could fulfill myself. I heard him in the sermon. Don't do that, because there won't be any money for food. So please try to recognize that whatever is the income is the income. It's not, though, fellas, what you want her to be. It's what God wants her to be. What does God want your wife to be? You're going to answer to Jesus Christ for whether you try to make her over in your image or whether you try to make her over in the help God make her over in the image he wants her to be. Christ is not marrying us because we're like him in all of our personal interests and needs. That's why he never told us the colors he liked, that he likes pistachio ice cream, and maybe we like strawberry. That's okay. That's not a sin. He likes a blue suit. We might like to wear a gray suit. That's okay. He doesn't care. So when he marries his bride, he's not going to worry whether she likes to wear a purple instead of burgundy or something, if that's what he might prefer. I'm trying to use an illustration so that we understand it is crucial. I've seen so many husbands constantly just trying to fashion their wives. God is the potter. We're the clay. You encourage your wife to become herself. Don't wrap your arms around her and start fashioning her like you're the potter and she's your clay. Encourage her to become herself. Point eight. Be willing and wise enough to seek her counsel. What? I am king here. I issue decrees. And my motto with my wife is, yours is not to reason why. Yours is but to do or die. My mother would say that to me. Sometimes my mother would say that. My mother could say that to me. Your mother could say that to you. And the parents can say that to children, but that's not the way a man who has any smarts and wisdom and savvy at all would treat somebody else who could help him stay out of difficulty and not get himself in trouble because he goes to his wisest counselor, a counselor who knows his proclivities better than anybody else. I hardly do anything without asking my wife's opinion. I won't buy a tie without her there. I just won't. I know she has a sense of things. I know where not to ask her. If I'm going to buy a bush, I don't ask my wife's permission. She would have no idea. She said, I like this one. I said, no, honey, that's a tree. I want a bush. Well, what about this one? That's grass. She's better than that. You should want and need her ideas. Your wife has wonderful ideas if you learn how to tap them, like the Proverbs say. Maybe she's a deep well, but a wise person will draw out that deep well. Remember this. Two partially good ideas can become a wonderful idea when properly merged. Two partially good ideas can become a wonderful idea when properly merged. I don't care whether you think of yourself as a king, which you shouldn't. You think of yourself as the chief executive officer of the home, which you shouldn't. Or the president, or the head, or ruler, or leader. It doesn't make any difference how you may see your office. And of course it should be as God says, but I'm just saying humanly, I want to illustrate a point here for a moment. The president of the company, the chief executive officer, a king doesn't do everything. He delegates, and not just the stuff he doesn't want to do. The greatest leaders are those who create an environment so that their subordinates can succeed. The greatest leaders conduct themselves as though they are assisting their assistants, because to the degree you help your wife help you, you've helped yourself. Not that you should do it for selfish reasons, but it'll come back that way. It will come back that way. There are men that won't let their wives drive. I had a man tell me, sat right in my office, and he admitted, we were talking one time, and I said, why don't you let your wife drive? And he didn't want to say. Finally came and said, look, I'll just admit it. It's a control thing. And I would see his wife walking around, and he said, it's a control thing. I want to control my wife, so I won't let her drive. That's exactly why he wouldn't let her drive. Admitted it. Sat right there. My wife heard him say it. You probably wouldn't guess. This is quite some time ago. But I think, what a hideous, monstrous thing to do to a woman. There are people who don't want to drive. My grandmother was that way. She didn't drive for 73 years. She had a wreck when she was 19 and said, that's it, I'm never getting behind a wheel again. She kept her word for 73 years and died at 92 and never drove again. And that's different. That's wrong. When my grandmother comes up in the resurrection, I'm going to say, you know, Grand Mary, that's what I called her, I'm going to teach you to drive. And she'll learn. This little teeny woman, amazing. I'm her grandson. I don't understand it. Ephesians 5 and verse 25 said, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. Husbands, love your wives. Even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. Now, the church is, we are technically servants. We are bond slaves of Jesus Christ. Don't take this too far. This has happened. Your wife is not your slave. You are in charge of her. You're responsible for her, just as she is responsible for the children when you're not there. And you delegate to her leadership over the children. Obviously, you would delegate other things to her, the checkbook, the car. You'd want to tell her certain things that she needs to know to take care of herself when you're gone, because you are to provide for her. He that provides not for his own family, starting with his wife, is worse than an unbeliever. Unbelievers are pretty bad when you read what's going to happen to them. Worse than an infidel. Worse than an unbeliever. Proverbs 31. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land, describing the, no pun intended, the proverbial Proverbs 31 woman. We talk about the Proverbs 31 women. It's almost the proverbial Proverbs 31 woman. There's a connection between how the woman's counsel is sought and the fact that her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land, partly for what she does, including her counsel. Your husband or your wife may have some enormous insight. I just couldn't even imagine making any kind of a decision without talking to my wife. I used to do all the books in the family, so to speak. I handled the budget totally for a long time, longer probably than I should have or needed to. My wife was very innovative, and I was tougher than I should be. I'll just say that. Now my wife, for years, handles the check. I don't write one check a year. I used to write virtually all of them, or certainly direct to my wife how to do it or whatever. When we were younger in our marriage, for years, I can't remember even when we changed, it's been a number of years. Of course, we always talked about expenses back and forth, but at a certain point, I finally just said, this is silly, she knows what she's doing, and I just turned the finances over to my wife. And it's been okay since then. No, I'm just kidding. Number nine. Your wife will tend to become what you want her and inspire her to be. Now, this is I got into this in 7, but I'm giving it a separate point because it is so important. Turn over to Ecclesiastes 9:9. You might be just a few pages away there in Proverbs. Live joyfully with the wife of your youth, whom you love all the days of the life of your vanity, which he's given you under the sun, and so forth. Live joyfully with the wife of your youth. If your wife is around someone who is filled with joy, she will feel it herself. People tend to take on the environment they enter. Only the very strongest people can be themselves against whatever environment they find themselves in. It's natural. She will tend to do that. If you scream at your wife, you are disqualified at that moment from being her husband. God does not scream at us. Jesus Christ does not scream at the church. Every husband certainly has yelled at his wife, so you probably have done the same. Go back to Proverbs 31 again. Just turn right back again. Who can find a virtuous woman, for her price is far above rubies? You know, if your wife will grow to be more virtuous if you inspire her to be. It doesn't mean, okay, I'm going to go out and find this woman from the start. That's wonderful, and if you can do that, if you get this extraordinary woman who's already with price far above rubies, that's wonderful. But there's nothing that says a husband cannot inspire his wife to add more value to herself. It doesn't say that all women are found that way. Your wife will be whatever you want her to be. If you want her to be a slave and you treat her like a slave, eventually she'll act like a slave. You want her to be a hag and look like a hag and treat her like a hag, eventually she'll be one and she'll look haggard too. You want her to be a plain Jane, she'll be a plain Jane. You want her to be a princess, she'll be a princess eventually. Treat her like she's a queen, and eventually you can make your wife into a queen. You want your wife to be exciting? Treat her and act in an excited fashion around her. With your wife's hands in the dishwater, maybe curlers in her hair, the next time you see her that way, be sure you don't have to say it, but be sure you remember that you love her in that way. She may look far from her best, but you want to look at her when she is far from her best, sometime quietly on your own when she's not seeing it, and just say to yourself, I love that woman, and treat her as though you do, and then remember to inspire her. Now, why do you think it is that couples eventually over time begin to look alike? You've heard that, look alike? Well, my wife and I kid ourselves about that. We say, you know, we'll never look alike. She's brown-eyed, I'm blue-eyed. She's not going to grow taller or me shorter or whatever. We don't think we'll look alike in that way. But many couples, they do. There are a number of reasons for that. Most of them are good. And there's some that you might have never thought about. There is truth to it. Consider. Now, suppose you both tend, after 20 or 30 years, to be around each other and talk a lot, you'll both tend to laugh at the same things. Your faces will tend to reflect, or you'll be sad at the same things. Your faces will tend to reflect much the same thing at the same time when you're around each other. Some couples sort of even begin to dress a little bit alike. If they do enough things together, their figures could almost, there are limits to this, look the same. You know, one wouldn't be real heavy and the other one a beanpole or something. You know, there are reasons. Of course, in the world, people eat the same food. And of course, this is true too. You eat the same food, you're going to tend to enjoy the same health and have some of the same coloring as a result. In the world, they would maybe also cut their hair the same. I've even seen it where it's similar, not exactly the same, but couples. And then, of course, as you get older, remember, if you both get gray, it didn't make any difference if one of you had black hair and one of you had red hair. When you both get gray, you tend to look the same. You know, you tend to, maybe your eyes go bad. Both have glasses. Maybe one did before. And pretty soon, you begin to think the same. Now, you start saying certain things that you picked up from the other one. And there is a bonding, a kind of a unifying later in life, because what we do and say to our mate, both ways, is far more important, has far greater and broader and bigger reach than we might ever think. Look at 1 Corinthians 7 as a conclusion to this part. We might have time to do one point to the wives. 1 Corinthians 7. First Corinthians chapter 7, once again, as I said, we will come back to this in a couple of weeks. Well, here we are back to it today. But in verse 12, it says, "But to the rest speak I, not the Lord. If any brother has a wife that believe not, and she be pleased to dwell with him, let her not put her away. A woman which has a husband that believes not, if he be pleased to dwell with her, let her not leave him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the believing wife is sanctified by the husband. Else were your children unclean, but now are they holy. But if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. But God has called us to peace." Verse 16. "For what know you, O wife, whether you shall save your husband? Or how know you, O man, whether you shall save your wife?" Now, only Christ can save us. What this means is, how do you know whether or not your example is so if it's so wonderful, and it's so good, and it's so kind, and it's so Christ-like — this could go either way, I realize — it's so Christian that it actually causes the other person to want to obey God, and God says, "You know, I'm going to call them." The person says, I want to go this way. The scripture's there. How do you know? How do you know, O wife or husband, whether you'd save your husband or wife? That shows you, in the ultimate sense, through that lone scripture, how you can inspire a person to really be all they can be, because they might literally pass right out of not just wanting to spend their life with you or be the husband or wife or the father or mother of your children, but may actually want to copy your entire value system reflected through Christianity, your Christianity. Do you think that's possible? God says it is. God says it is. Now, women, take a moment. You had an advantage. You've heard the points to the men. Just take a moment. Typically, I will say, and this still almost applies, I will say, you've got 1 week, ladies, because I start with the men. You've got 1 week to think about, I wonder what the 9 points to us are going to be. Talked about the 9 points to the men. And we touched on some of the things you do, too, and we'll touch on some of the things the men do. You can't just go all one way or the other. There's too much overlap. But stop and think. What might they be? What might they be? We have time for at least one point. You'll get to hear one of them. Turn to Titus chapter 2. Point number one to the wives. Take care of the needs at home. Take care of the needs at home. Now, nobody in the world is going to tell you that. They're going to tell you you're not self-actualizing, you're not fulfilling yourself, you're not reaching to your incredible human potential. They don't know what our incredible human potential is. If you're stuck at home, barefoot and pregnant, and with bobby pins in your hair. And that's the way a lot of people sort of see the old-style woman. But I'm a 90s woman, or I'm a 21st century woman. That beats the 90s women. And I'm out there. Now, 55% of all the graduates of college are women. 45% are men. That means that eventually, women are going to literally take over. And, of course, there are a lot of women who are very upset out there in the world, not wanting to take care of the needs at home, as we'll read here. But in fact, they see themselves as stifled, held back. We should hold 55% of executive leadership positions. And more times, or just as many times as not, if somebody has to quit the job and go be Mr. Mom, it might be Mr. Dad / Mom, instead of just Mr. Mom or Mrs. Mom, so to speak. And in the world, the roles of the sexes are so fouled up. The roles of husband and wife and the families are so fouled up, is it any wonder that there aren't very many families out there anymore, like the Nelsons? or the Cleavers, who were at least worldly families that you might want to copy a little bit from the past. Titus chapter 2 and verse 3. The aged women likewise, that they be behavior as becomes holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children. Now this is what women are to teach them. There are some things husbands should never have to teach their wives. There are obviously things that some wives would feel like they needed to teach their husbands and should never have to. They should have been taught by other people. To be discreet. There are women who are not discreet. They're just indiscreet. What is the proverb? Like a jewel in a swine's snout, so is a fair woman without discretion. Discretion shall preserve you and understanding shall keep you, says in the Proverbs. To be discreet. Do you know how to say wise, tactful things? Some women are very wise and very tactful. This is a little bit away from the point, but I want to just stress it. Some women are very wise and tactful. Other women just always say dumb stuff. They just, oh, ghastly. And just, and they, well, I just don't ever know what to say, and they never get any better. It's possible for older women, if you don't know what to say and you're always just saying indiscreet stuff, blatting stuff out, you know what? Start talking to older women, because you missed it when you were younger. You missed it. There are some women who are very wise and some just constantly say dumb stuff. And there are men the same way, but we're talking about the women here in context. Chaste, not chaste, C-H-A-S-E-D. And my husband has to chase me. It says I'm supposed to be chaste. No, it's not. It's different spelling. Okay. Keepers at home. I've often said that does not mean keep her at home. Okay, that's different. That's keepers at home. Your wife should be allowed to get out. She should be allowed to do certain things. But still, she's a keeper at home. There's nowhere in the Bible that says that husbands do that. Good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. Now, that's important. When a husband comes home, there's nothing worse than seeing the house as a wreck. It looked like a hand grenade went off in every room. And there's just nothing worse than that. Be sure you take care of the needs at home, not slow and lazy and slothful with things that need to be done. Stay up with it. Keep the house shining and sharp and looking good. Proverbs 14 and verse 1. Now, keepers at home, of course, means the children too. It means all kinds of things. You have to be a little bit of fixer-upper in you. Every wise woman builds her house, but the foolish plucks it down with her hands, just tearing it apart or building it up. Which are you? Can you fix things? I just can't ever do anything right. I just can't ever do anything. I'm blessed to have a woman who can fix all kinds of things. She can fix more things in the house. I can fix things outside the house. I fix some things inside. I'm very thankful for her. A foolish plucks it down with her hands, just sort of tears things up, degrades the house, the environment, never quite figures out how to edify and lift up the dwelling. And of course, all of Proverbs 31 could be read. Let's pick that up a little bit. I think we have a little extra time here. Proverbs 31. Who can find a virtuous woman? We read verse 11. The heart of her husband does trust safely in her, so that he has no need of spoil. Spoil means he has to go out and steal to make up for what she does wrong. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works willingly with her hands. That's quite a picture, more a picture of 100 years ago than today. Today, women willingly reach in and put TV dinner in the oven. It's been going on for 30 and 40 years. I had a few TV dinners when I was growing up. Now, she's like the merchant ship. She brings her food from afar. She's out shopping. That's all part of being a good keeper at home, but you can't do that if you keep her at home. She rises up also while it is yet night. In other words, it's early in the morning. She gets up early. She's not lazy, sleeps in, nothing to do, and wants to enjoy the country club lifestyle, and gives meat to her household and a portion to her maidens, her helpers. That suggests that there are people helping her because she's such a good wife, her husband's successful, and there may even be people there that assist. She considers a field and buys it. Does that sound like a woman who's got handcuffs on her by a husband who says, "I'm in charge here"? You say, no. With the fruit of her hand, she plants a vineyard, not a flower, a vineyard. And that's after she figured out where the field should be and bought it. Now she got the money and got approval from her husband. This wouldn't go against other verses. And there's some who tried to read this and exclude that they didn't have to do what their husband said. We just read that blasphemes the word of God. She goes out and considers a field and buys it. Women have said, that means right there. I've seen people pick up these verses and use them to twist it and say, she shouldn't have to get approval from her husband, even for major expenditures. I know ministers' wives who began to reason that way. She girds her loins with strength and strengthens her arms. She's not afraid of vigorous work. She perceives that her merchandise is good. Her candle goes not out by night. She doesn't go to bed real early and get up late. She burns the candle, so to speak, at both ends. It comes from this verse. Burns the candle at both ends. She gets up at night and goes to bed when it's night and talks about her candle goes not out. She burns the candle at both ends. She doesn't ruin her health, but she works hard and she might actually have calluses by work, exercise, recreation, vigorous work. She lays her hands to the spindle and her hands hold the distaff. She stretches out her hand to the poor. This is an extraordinary picture. Does this sound like the 21st century women of the world? Are you kidding? They might say, I agree with the part about considering and buying a field and hiring a bunch of people to plant the vineyard because I would own the winery. You understand the point. But this is an incredibly creative, talented, innovative woman of initiative and resourcefulness. Extraordinary. She always has time for other people, too. She reaches out her hand to the poor. She reaches out her hands to the needy, and she's not afraid of the snow for her household. I have a bad back, and my wife has kind of a bad back, too. And part of the reason is I shoveled snow in Buffalo for years. Sometimes I hear my wife out, and she's shoveling the snow, but she pushes it. She doesn't shovel it. And if it's an inch, she just pushes it off our driveway. And it makes me feel guilty. Of course, I shovel the snow a lot. Anytime it has to be shoveled, I shovel it. But, my back is fused and there's problems there, and she doesn't shovel. For all her household are clothed with scarlet. That means double garments. This is scarlet. She makes herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. She's well-dressed. We read verse 23 about her husband. She makes fine linen and sells it and delivers girdles unto the merchant. I mean, she might be making a little extra money for the house, strength and honor her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and her tongue is the law of kindness. She looks well to the ways of her husband and eats not the bread of idleness. You know, you stop and you just realize, how has the devil convinced hundreds of millions of women that they have to go out and run a company, get a job in the world, abandon the home, just turn the kids loose, put a latchkey around their neck, or they haven't lived, they haven't fulfilled themselves. Now, yes, it's wonderful if a woman can go out and get a job and has to, and circumstances may dictate it. Oh, sometimes it's absolutely essential. Matter of fact, in some cases, a woman didn't work, the family wouldn't eat. There's husbands who can't work. And in this society, sometimes women have to get a job too. Please do not think I'm saying that they shouldn't. It's just some people believe that that's the only way you fulfill your destiny. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done virtuously, but you excel them all, the woman described here. Favor is deceitful. People want to get ahead by politics, and beauty is vain, and beauty opens a lot of doors of men. But they won't get you a wonderful husband. They won't help you in the kingdom of God. But a woman that fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. Take care of the needs at home. We'll finish next time.